This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Emergency mental health care is often a topic of conversation after a horrific event when communities try to find reason behind a perpetrator's actions. Whether things get violent or not, the question remains, how are emergency mental health situations identified and how are they handled? When police are called because someone is believed to be a danger to themselves or others, what happens? What level of control do medical professionals have and what role do police play in crisis situations? Lots of questions. We'll get to those in a moment. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now, we have Dr. Diane Rice, a psychiatrist at IU Health, to give us a little bit more insight into this topic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Rice, I want to start with what we kind of talked about at the top of this opening here, that we often hear about mental health emergencies in relation to a crisis event. Does that mean these emergencies are rare, or is it that we only hear them when they are headline-grabbing situations?
I would argue that it's very much the latter. These are actually incredibly common situations. There are a number of hospitals in the Indianapolis area alone that have psychiatric emergency services that either have a designated area or a specific kind of plan and service structure designed to address emergency psychiatric needs. And even in hospitals that may not have a psychiatrist on staff, all hospitals that have an emergency room have to be prepared to receive patients who are experiencing a psychiatric emergency and have a plan in place for evaluating and transferring or otherwise managing those patients. It's a common everyday occurrence.
So you're a psychiatrist. What is your experience in dealing with mental health emergencies?
So I've been a psychiatrist here at IU Methodist for about 2.5 years. And prior to that, my other Indiana experience was at more on the outpatient side at IU Health Arnett. So I've dealt with this some, both as somebody in the community trying to identify services and then as the person who winds up seeing and assessing patients in the hospital. And it's certainly a complex system and can feel very sort of Kafka-esque some days. On the outpatient side, it's always a challenge to feel like you're able to accurately identify patients whose symptoms have risen to the level that they really require everything involved in an emergency room visit, waiting in a waiting room, potentially for hours, being in a medical setting that can feel kind of cold and sterile. And as I don't know anybody who ever, feels like time in an emergency room is their very favorite time. As fantastic as our emergency room colleagues are. And then sometimes in Indiana and in many other states, people can wait for multiple days if they are determined to need admission for a bed to be open. There are complex insurance networks where, for instance, a patient may be in network with their medical insurance, but not in network for their mental health coverage with a given system. So even if they deliberately went to their in-network hospital, they may then have to be transferred. There are a lot of barriers that can come up just to sort of the basic process of getting somebody to the hospital, medically evaluating them and making sure that they're stable, psychiatrically evaluating them and making sure that either inpatient care is the most needed and appropriate level of care, or working on alternatives that allow the person to stay in the community, and then securing a bed or arranging those services.
Mm-hmm. And just to give our audience a little bit insight, because probably most of what we hear is from what we see in news reports or movies or whatever. What is a mental health emergency? What constitutes an emergency?
Well, it can be all over the map. I think that the most common things that we think about as mental health emergencies are people who are experiencing new or worsened suicidal thoughts, and maybe even are at the point where they've started to make a plan for suicide, or they're making arrangements moving towards that plan, or who have even gone so far as to make a suicide attempt. I think that's probably the most common and kind of classic mental health emergency. The other thing is that when somebody is experiencing psychotic symptoms to the extent that it's really keeping them from being able to sort of meet their own basic needs and safely navigate the outside world, that's another reason that people are brought in. Often, substance abuse, particularly if somebody is intoxicated on a substance, can lead to either the police or EMS being called and somebody being brought in for further evaluation. But believe it or not, those are often kind of complex cases when they arrive. But once mm-hmm. somebody has had the chance to metabolize that substance, usually those are somewhat straightforward, at least in that we kind of know what the next steps are.
And with your work in the emergency room, are there certain cases that you see or mental health needs that you see that are more common than others?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, if we look epidemiologically, major depressive disorder, you know, which is just the clinical term for depression, is an incredibly common disorder, and something like 20% of people will experience at least one major depressive episode in the course of their lives. So a minority, but a non-trivial minority of those cases will at some point become so severe that there are real concerns about somebody's ability to maintain their own safety. So depression with related suicidal thoughts are extremely common. Substance abuse and intoxication, and that can be alcohol, that can be you know, things like methamphetamines or heroin or other street drugs. It can be prescription misuse. It can be some of these synthetic substances like spice or molly or things like that. But substance intoxication is probably the other most common thing. But then also exacerbations of psychotic disorders or bipolar disorders, where somebody presents manic or psychotic or with symptoms of both, are probably the third most common. And those three things are kind of our bread and butter.
People come in and sometimes they have to wait for a few hours. It might take a while in the emergency room. Let's say somebody had ingested something and it triggered an episode of some sort. Are they prioritized, or could they also end up in that kind of situation where they're waiting for a while?
Generally, if somebody has come in through an ambulance with EMS or with the police, then they will be fairly quickly triaged back to the emergency room and receive at least an initial assessment from our ER staff as quickly as somebody is safely available. Generally, also, if somebody is kind of altered by a substance to the point that they kind of aren't able to safely sit in a waiting room, then that would get moved fairly quickly as well. I was just going to say that just like anything that comes into an emergency room, you know, the first question is, what's the immediate need that keeps somebody, you know, alive and healthy?
Mm-hmm. And are there particular hospitals in the area that are more equipped to deal with mental health emergencies, or are all hospitals the same?
Well, I think some hospitals have either specific areas of their emergency room or a small unit or area that's designed for psychiatric assessment and observation. So Eskenazi has one of these. We have one of these here at Methodist. St. Vincent has very clear emergency psychiatric protocols. I'm a little bit less familiar with the assessment procedures at Community North, but they certainly have a robust psychiatric service and staff, and so have assessment capabilities that they use very regularly. I just don't know the exact details of their unit.
Mm-hmm. We often hear things like someone will be placed on a psychiatric hold. What does that exactly mean?
So in the state of Indiana, when people use the term psychiatric hold, what they're usually talking about is something called an emergency detention order, which is sometimes abbreviated an ED or an EDO. And what that is essentially the legal framework that we have to hold somebody against their will if they're wanting to leave the hospital. Mm-hmm. So what it requires is, first off, just it's two pages. The first page has information about who is this person, when did they get to the hospital, and a little bit about what was going on, that there have been some concerns raised. And then the second form is the second page is a physician statement that gives at least a provisional diagnosis and a brief rationale for why the physician feels that this person needs to be detained. That can actually be filled out by any physician. It doesn't have to be a psychiatrist. But the purpose of that is then to hold the person against their will, if needed, for up to 3 business days to be able to further evaluate and assess their current psychiatric condition in need and be able to offer whatever intervention is appropriate at that time. So usually when we use an emergency detention order, it's for somebody who we feel strongly needs inpatient psychiatric care, but they do not feel that they need that and they are wanting to leave the hospital. Importantly, it does not give us the right to do anything other than keep that person in the hospital. So it doesn't force the person to take a certain medication or force them to participate in any other therapies or anything like that. It's truly just the means by which we can keep somebody in the hospital.
I do want to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to take a quick break. I do want to delve a little more into when you can do things despite somebody's objection. We'll be back with our guest after a quick break. We're talking about emergency mental health care, how medical professionals respond when someone has an urgent psychiatric issue. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about emergency mental health care and what happens when someone needs urgent help due to a psychiatric issue and what control medical professionals have over what happens to the individual. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're joined again by Dr. Diane Rice, a psychiatrist at IU Health. Dr. Rice, before the break, we briefly were touching up upon when somebody's placed in a hold and how medical professionals can't force them to take any sort of medication during that period. Is there an instance where that would be something where a medical professional would give them something despite their objections?
Yeah, so the situation in which medical professionals, either psychiatrists or any other medical professionals, can use medication over somebody's objection is a situation in which that medication is attempting to prevent harm to that patient or to somebody else. So say somebody comes into our emergency room and is very, very agitated related to a substance that they've taken. We may give them medication, even if they don't agree to that, to try and prevent that person from harming others. So say they're swinging at the ER staff or trying to hit or bite people or things like that. In that situation, we're allowed to use medication, even if the person isn't agreeing to it. The goal, certainly, when a medication is selected at that point, too, is as much as possible to choose something that's going to be therapeutic for whatever it is that's causing this condition in the person. So we may use medications like benzodiazepines or antipsychotics with the hope that along with helping to prevent that immediate risk of harm, that we'll also actually have some therapeutic effect for the patient and try and to start to remediate whatever is underlying this behavior.
Mm-hmm. And once somebody's placed on a hold or eventually discharged, is there a system that would follow up with these individuals to make sure that they're getting the help that they need afterward?
Yeah, so generally it's a requirement that hospitals have discharge plans in place for after a patient is discharged. And the goal is always to have them followed up with in about 7 days. Unfortunately, really in most places in the country, but Indiana very much included, getting somebody in front of a psychiatrist within 7 days is incredibly difficult. And sometimes even getting them in front of a master's level therapist or our psychologist colleagues who are doctoral level practitioners, but who do not prescribe medications and have a lot more background in therapy, but also in assessment and testing, sometimes in research, things like that. It can take sometimes as long as a month or two for somebody to actually get the follow-up that we would hope for. If somebody is seen in the emergency room and is discharged, likewise, so in Indiana and in a number of other states, the public mental health sector is organized at the county level, and there are different organizations that serve a given county. So here in Marion County, the Eskenazi Mental Health System is one large one. Adult and Child is another community mental health system that sees a large number of patients. And then Aspire, Gallahue, I believe Cummins has an office on the west side. I'm sure I'm missing a few, but there are several. In a lot of counties in the state, there may only be one, and sometimes those systems are spread among multiple counties. So for instance, around Logansport, the four-county community mental health system covers the four counties around Logansport. Centerstone covers the Bloomington area and a number of the counties around there. But often those are systems... those were systems that were actually developed when state psychiatric hospitals were closed in the 70s and into the early 80s. And the goal was that we would essentially replace that very high level of care with community-based services that would robustly meet the needs of people who are experiencing mental illnesses and mental health crises. Unfortunately, the systems that were actually developed and funded have never been nearly as robust as one would hope for. So they tend to always struggle to have adequate resources. Because of that, they often have to make really difficult decisions about balancing how many staff they can hire at different levels of training. It's, for instance, more expensive to hire a psychiatrist or a psychologist than it is to hire somebody at the master's level, but then there may be skill sets or a need for supervision that you're missing. But ultimately, those are sort of the emergency safety net system. Then obviously there are also either hospital system affiliated or private clinics, and those are much more variable in terms of whether they accept insurance, what insurance plans they'll accept, whether they would accept Medicaid or HIP or Hoosier HealthWise type plans, or if they exclusively take commercial plans. So again, you can get into a situation where even if you've identified somebody and maybe even identified somebody who can see a patient on the desired timeline, then there's the question of whether that can be funded and whether that's realistic right. for a patient.
Right. And you know, speaking of the funding, there seem to always be disparities when it comes in particular to mental health treatment. What is the underlying cause? Is it that it's still not seen as an important part of medical coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of the practical side to that question, and then there's the philosophical side to that question. I mean, certainly mental health needs have often at different times been treated either as a character flaw or as a mm-hmm. choice, or as somehow reflecting badly on kind of the person's self-care abilities or things like that. And I think that there certainly has been some progress in American society in general and in our area at helping people to recognize that mental illness is illness. And illness is something that good medical care can often at least help with. From a systems standpoint, we've always, for reasons I don't really know, actually segregated kind of our physical medical care from our mental health care and tend to have different systems, often different insurance plans or coverage. Mm-hmm. And so the way those systems align and talk to each other has often been very fractured. And then there's just the basic fact that if, for instance, I submit a code to most insurance companies for an outpatient moderate complexity visit, and my colleagues in other kind of non-psychiatric medical specialties submit that same code, they will be reimbursed at a higher rate. So it makes it more difficult for psychiatrists in the community sector in an outpatient setting to kind of meet their own financial bottom line.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it sounds like there's still some major reforms needed in the healthcare industry to kind of align everybody on the same page. I know you mentioned earlier that it can be really hard to find a psychiatrist if somebody had an emergency situation, you know, within a week later to follow up with. And aside from cost and insurance coverage, is it that there aren't enough psychiatrists to handle the number of people?
Yeah, so Indiana, when I last looked this up, I think has 6.6 psychiatrists per 100,000 people. And just to put that into context, that's a little over half of the national average. And the recommended number that I believe it's the World Health Organization uses is 15 psychiatrists per 100,000 people to sort of provide what we would consider an adequate level of coverage and services. So for psychiatrists, we're at just over a third that.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to situations, emergency health situations, we often hear that some people fall through the cracks or some incident occurred and somebody had mentioned that they were experiencing a crisis. Is this because there aren't enough people following up or the ability to follow up? What causes a situation like that?
Well, it can be a whole variety of things. So certainly the ability to efficiently and sort of fluidly get somebody into follow-up care after they've experienced an emergency psychiatric evaluation or have spent time on an inpatient psychiatric unit is really important. Everything that we can do that really helps that handoff be effective, where somebody then has follow-up care with somebody that they identify, feel like they've already built some connection to, even if it's just sort of an institutional connection, and then are able to smoothly, quickly, and efficiently get in to see that person. And mm-hmm. ideally, that person also has access to the information about what was going on that brought them to the hospital, what interventions they may have experienced while they were in the emergency room or in an inpatient setting, and then what the discharge plan was, will then help it feel kind of more like the seamless care that all of us would hope for if ourselves or if a loved one was experiencing any healthcare need. The other challenge is that most of the time, once somebody has left the emergency room or left the hospital, well, we can recommend and try to connect and encourage and exhort. We can't actually force people to follow up. And so if part of somebody's illness is a lack of insight into the fact that something is wrong or that there is something going on in them that would be amenable to treatment and that may help their life go better if it's treated, we can't generally force them to come in. Now, there are actually legal mechanisms that you can use to do that, but the bar for that is very high. We're certainly a society that places a high value on individual liberties and civil liberties. And psychiatry, unfortunately, historically has been an abuser of mm-hmm. those. And so I would argue reasonably there have been real restrictions placed on the use of psychiatric diagnosis, intervention, holds, hospitalizations, to make sure that we balance that with people's civil liberties, but it can be a difficult balance.
Right. And so, I mean, what would you do if you had a patient that is a danger to others and you can't really do anything if they don't want to get the help that they need? How do you prevent them from causing damage?
Yeah, well, so if a patient shows, if they've come in and been assessed and been found to, say, need inpatient psychiatric care, and at the end of those 3 business days or those 72 hours that they're under an emergency psychiatric hold, one thing that the inpatient team can do is file for essentially for a more prolonged mental health commitment. It's called a civil commitment. And so the first step of that is a temporary commitment, which lasts for 90 days. And then if that's then ultimately converted to a more ongoing commitment, that's reviewed annually. But a civil commitment can allow both for administration of medication or other treatment over the person's objection, and can actually mandate that they continue to follow up as an outpatient. And if somebody is not doing that, so if they're supposed to present to the clinic once a month for follow-up care or something like that, and they're failing to do so, the community mental health center that holds that commitment can reach out to generally to the local sheriff's department and request that the sheriff brings that person back in for further assessment and stabilization if needed. That's something called an apprehend and return. But the bar for that is very high, and it requires an actual formal court hearing for somebody to get placed on a civil commitment.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a lot of elements that need to be considered. Are there certain other states that have a system that maybe Indiana could take note of? I know, because I know you mentioned that Indiana doesn't have enough psychiatrists per number of people. Are there any states that are doing it better?
I mean, in terms of attracting psychiatrists or building a psychiatric workforce, as with almost any medical specialty, the most effective way to do it is to kind of build people locally. So here at the IU School of Medicine, we have the state's largest psychiatry residency. For a long time, it had been the only residency program training psychiatrists in Indiana. We now actually have three other programs, none of which are quite as large, but which are in different parts of the state. So the community health system opened a residency program, and I believe that their first class of residents is graduating in just a few weeks. I'm not 100% certain if I've got that correct, that this is their inaugural class, but they will be graduating a group of residents in a few weeks. And there are new programs now that have opened up in Vincennes and Evansville in that south, I believe, southwestern corner of the state. And then there's a brand new program that's pretty soon in the Gary area that will be training another few residents each year. So we are increasing the number of people who are being trained in Indiana. In terms of attracting a mental health workforce more generally, psychiatrists are only one piece of a larger puzzle when it comes to caring for patients with mental health needs. I mean, Indiana has, I believe, already started to at least consider adjusting some of its requirements and credit transfers and things like that from other states when it comes to licensure of master's level mental health providers, like licensed mental health counselors or licensed clinical social workers. And then certainly we have a few different psychology PhD programs in the state, but being able to build the number of psychology internships, which is where psychologists finish their training and are prepared for independent practice and licensure, could also be an important step in having people come, get connected to Indiana, and hopefully put down roots here and stay.
Mm-hmm. And in your years of practice, have you noticed a change in sort of the stigma that's surrounded mental health for too long? Is that changing at all?
I've been out of medical school for 11 years now. I guess in that time, I think that there have been changes in the stigma, often that are related to particular diagnoses or awareness of particular diagnoses. I think that the way we've started to talk, for instance, about autism spectrum disorders has actually made some progress in recent years. And we've kind of gone beyond just using Rain Man as our framework for talking about autism spectrum disorders and people who have, who have autism. I still think that there's really poor understanding generally of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and some of those other more chronic and severe mental illnesses that can really have a huge impact on people's lives, but that don't necessarily mean that somebody is always ill or that they're dangerous to themselves or dangerous to anyone else. And I think that our the way that we talk and think about mental health is often very colored, either by Hollywood or by kind of what we see in these most extreme and most tragic circumstances. And we underemphasize a huge number of people in our community who manage mental health needs very well today.
Absolutely. So definitely a lot more education needed on that front. Dr. Diane Rice, thank you so much for joining us. She's a psychiatrist at IU Health. We'll be back after a quick break with a conversation on the police's role in crisis situations involving mental health. What do police departments do with people who need help, and what can be done to make things better? I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Back now to our discussion on emergency mental health care. We've talked in the show so far about how hospitals and psychiatrists respond when a call comes in that someone is having dangerous psychiatric issues. Now we're going to talk about what role police departments play. To help us do that, we're joined by Sergeant Lance Dardine from the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, or IMPD. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to start by learning a little bit about what the police department does. I hear that there's something called a mobile crisis assistance team. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we have quite a few avenues that we use. So do you want me to kind of start at the beginning of how these units started?
Sure, that'd be great.
Sure. So in 2016, we started a program called the Behavioral Health Unit, and that basically partnered a licensed mental health professional from the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center, along with a police officer, and they went on the districts to try to follow up on individuals that were in crisis that had been taken to the hospital by an IMPD officer. Mm-hmm. And the thought was to follow up with them and try to get those individuals connected to the most appropriate resources and try to find out what was the cause behind that 911 call and what was the cause behind the hospitalization, and so we can try to get them connected in the most appropriate way. And that program really took off. It became very successful. We started out on 5 out of the 6 districts, and we soon realized that officers were calling this unit that was technically more of a reactive unit on the back end, you know, because we were following up after the crisis was over. Mm-hmm. But officers really found us being useful when there was an active 911 call, so like an active crisis. And so we started in August of 2017 a program called MCAT, the Mobile Crisis Assistance Team. And their job was really to focus more on the active call, whereas the BHU was following up after the crisis. And we currently have 3 teams, and we're on 3 out of the 6 districts. And these officers are, again, partnered with a licensed clinician from the Sandra Eskenazi Mental Health Center, and they're responding to those 911 calls.
And so were you modeling this after any other sort of program anywhere in the country, or is this something totally unique?
So there are co-response teams all across the country. And, you know, we've looked at different models, but really, you know, every city really kind of needs to look at what their needs are and what the resources are and really come up with the best solution to their needs. We actually started MCAT with a paramedic as well. So we had a 3-person team. And in the 6-month trial period, we looked at the data and found that the paramedics weren't being used as much. So the paramedics pulled out. And I think that's important because, you know, just continually looking at the data and looking at what's working and what needs to be changed is very important because, again, these co-response teams are newer to policing and to communities. So, I mean, we can look at different models, but really it's about looking at your community and what their needs are.
Well, speaking of the community, I mean, how do these response units or teams, how do they, I guess, how much area are they able to cover?
That's a really good question. So right now our MCAT teams are on North District, Northwest District, and East District, which are our busier districts. And BHU covers Northeast, North, Southeast, Southwest, and Northwest. And it's ever-changing, you know, and I think it's something that, yeah, we would like to expand at some point. And, you know, we try to keep busy as much as we can and try to get people the help that we can.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, I think you said some of the teams are down to two people instead of three with the paramedic. Is there any goal to expand the team, or you found that this is the best size?
Yeah, so we feel that a police officer and a licensed clinician is just a good mix. And there's different expertise with each team and different experience. And we found that that works for our community.
Mm-hmm. What's it like for officers who have to respond to a crisis situation when there isn't a licensed professional available? I mean, do you normally, I guess I'm just wondering if you could take us through the process. Like when you get a call, how does it get to the point where you bring a licensed professional with you?
Yeah, great question. So all of our officers are trained in what's called mental health first aid. The entire department has been trained in that. We also have a CIT program that officers can voluntarily take, and that's 40-hour training. So a lot of officers are trained in both, and you know they can do the best they can to respond. But if they feel that the situation requires a licensed professional, they can get on the radio and call for an MCAT team. And if we're available, then that team will go out. And really, you know, we have the time, you know, and we can, once the scene is safe and the situation is under control, then a lot of times we can get the paramedics, the fire department, and other police officers back in service so they can keep taking their runs. And that MCAT team can take their time and really start peeling back the layers of that crisis and try to figure out what is the best solution.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen any changes over the years since implementing this? If you looked back like 5 years until now, has there been a big impact in having this type of work?
Well, we really do feel like there's a positive impact. We feel that the stigma surrounding mental health is going down. And so that's a huge win. And we're seeing that officers are looking at these types of runs in a different way. They're not really just trying to put a Band-Aid on it anymore. We're not trying to arrest our way out of this problem because we know that's not successful. And using these MCAT and BHU teams with that licensed professional, I think just it brings another level of expertise. And we're able to, you know, we're able to make some calls. We're able to get people into treatment and really just take the time to find out what's the most appropriate course of action.
Does this alleviate sort of the pressure working in law enforcement, trying to figure out what's going on with someone when you are able to bring a licensed professional along with you? Does that kind of, I don't know, relieve some of the stress?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I think that's a really good way to put it because it can be stressful when you're dealing with somebody or dealing with somebody in a crisis. Mm-hmm. Having that professional there with that experience and that licensing to really kind of put that expertise. And, you know, we do the best we can with training, but we are police officers. You know, we're not social workers or clinicians. So having that that professional there with us can really help kind of put that expertise into play.
And sort of speaking about having these health professionals and you saying, you know, you're not trained for like, well, you mentioned some training, but in general, I mean, this is not your field. But there have been elements of training now. I've been hearing other police departments across the country trying to implement, as you'd mentioned earlier, about mental health help training and things like that when people are in crisis. What sort of trainings do you feel that you have now that you wished you had like 10 years ago?
Well, mental health first aid is a really great program. And you can actually go on their website and any civilian can sign up for a course. We train in a different module. There's a public safety module that we use. And it's an intense 8-hour training that really focuses on the signs and symptoms of these mental illnesses, such as psychosis and substance use disorder, depression, anxiety. So we really find that useful for the officer to
kind of recognize, okay, well, it may be something like this, and maybe something like that. And I have some different tools in my tool belt now that I can use to deal with a psychosis rather than depression.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when it comes to CIT training, we've had that for years, since 2004. We have a little over, I think, 900 officers trained. And again, that's a very intense 40-hour, it's a full-week training. And I mean, we go through, you know, the whole gambit of, you know, traumatic brain injuries and autism and all the other mental health disorders, to really give officers a really good foundation and that knowledge base in case, you know, one of these mental health units aren't available.
Well, how does the pandemic impact all of this, you know, with social distancing and all these things that you have to put into play, wearing masks or being careful when you're around other people? How does that affect this work?
So at the very beginning, it was a little challenging because, you know, we were using the telephone quite a bit. We would still respond and we would actually call the person and, you know, we would be standing, you know, on the other side of their door talking to them. But they knew we were there to help. But, you know, as the vaccine and the pandemic kind of slowed down a little bit, you know, we went back to business as usual, you know, and we still maintain a safe distance and wear masks. But we're able to now kind of come in more contact with the individual. So it hasn't really impacted us too much. It did in the beginning, but as of now, it's getting back to business as usual.
Mm-hmm. And last year, it says that about a third of the calls you got were about suicidal thoughts or substance use. Is that still true today?
That's a great question. I have not looked at the recent stats on that. But it seemed about 3,500 immediate detentions we did last year, I believe about 800 or so had to do with some sort of suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm. And just for our listeners, what is a good number for people to call if they're dealing with some of these things?
Well, I mean, 911 is always the a really good option. And you can also ask for a CIT officer when you call. And if one is available, you know, that's that officer with that extra training. And, you know, if they're available to come, and then, you know, we're trying to get you the help that you need.
And when we think about challenges, when it comes to law enforcement officers responding to some of these calls, what are some of the challenges, for example, when it's the situation where substance abuse has been identified? Is that particularly challenging?
Yeah, it can be, especially if the individual is not willing to give help. And so we really just try to build a rapport. You know, we've worked with individuals, not just with substance use disorder, but, you know, other mental health conditions such as psychosis and schizophrenia and bipolar for years. And, you know, we've developed a really strong rapport with a lot of other citizens, because they know that we're just trying to help. But sometimes, you know, it takes a long time to get somebody into some sort of recovery. And mm-hmm. recovery looks different for everyone. So, you know, it is a challenge. But again, you know, we have the time as this unit to spend with somebody, to go out and make several home visits over, you know, several months or even several years. You know, we've taken people to their appointments. You know, most officers don't get a chance to do that. They're too busy. We're actually able to take people, you know, to the pharmacy to get their medication and help them get set up with their appointments. So just having that one-on-one time with an individual and help guide them to that path of recovery is really important.
So there's a lot of conversations surrounding law enforcement these days and whether law enforcement is really properly equipped to deal with mental health crises. What are your thoughts on some of these arguments that, you know, it's not police's job to try to deal with this situation?
I think that's a fair question. Is it really our job? And mm-hmm. I think it's going to be up to society and the lawmakers and legislation to really come together and think about, you know, what do we want our police officers to respond to? And until that legislation and until those other types of responses
kind of get ironed out, then we're just going to respond the best we can and help as many people as we can.
Do you think with some of this training and these programs that you have in place, it's eliminated perhaps maybe the amount of people that get arrested and end up in jail and they have mental health issues and they're not getting the help they need because it wasn't identified? Is that kind of alleviating that, or is that still an issue of you know, folks in jail who need mental health care?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. And I think there's kind of two parts to that. You know, some individuals that get arrested, they do have mental health problems. And, you know, the jail does have, you know, mental health workers that try to help them out and get them connected. But I really do think that we have realized, especially here at INPD, that, you know, we can't arrest our way out of this problem. And I think these officers on the street have recognized that and really are trying to do the best they can and take individuals to the hospital if that is appropriate, rather than arresting if they don't have to.
Right. And before we get ready to wrap up here, is there anything that would make a difference in your efforts on trying to help people who need mental health help to better identify, or is it training? Like, what is it that you think law enforcement needs?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I think just coming together as a community and trying to destigmatize mental health problems in all aspects, using organizations like NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. You know, if you have a family member that needs help, just realizing if you have to call the police, just let us know what's going on. So if we respond, we have the most information possible. Just being patient and understanding that these mental health problems, they're not going to go away in one night. And, you know, a lot of individuals, it takes time for them to realize that they need help. You know, we will do the best we can to get them that help, but it may take some time. So patience is really important.
And one more time, you said there's a number or a person people can ask for if they need help.
Yeah, so if you're calling like the local 911 or 911 number, you may ask for a CIT officer, which stands for the Crisis Intervention Team. And again, that's that officer who's had that 40-hour training. They can respond and they have that training to be able to try to de-escalate and have that knowledge base on these mental illnesses. So, you know, they can try to get you connected really to the most appropriate help.
If you're calling or, you know, if you're having like suicide or thoughts or whatever, you can always call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 800-273-8255. And that'll connect you to somebody there that can talk to you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Sergeant Lance Dardeen works for the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a discussion on Joe Biden's first 100 days in office with political analysts from across the state. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.